Welcome to The Property Wizard. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Freddie Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Freddie.
Well, welcome back, faithful listeners. I want to first of all thank Nathan Simon for that great intro tune. Nathan is part of the team at Carl Speaks. Thanks, guys. Terrific job. So let's recap from our last episode. Bernie, do you have any questions, comments?
Didn't realize how much a property management firm actually does. It's more than just a pair of screwdrivers and a team going out there. It's actually managing a whole host of things in the back office, you know, from validating your new tenants, collecting the rents.
Absolutely. Completely a la carte. Anytime you develop a relationship with a professional management company, you need to understand that their mandate is dictated by your needs and wants. So never be shy about asking. So super, let's move on to the mailbag. You've got mail. We have any emails from anybody, Bernie?
Yeah, we've had one from Sharon, who's kind of inquiring about my management experience.
Oh, great. Tremendous. Super question, Sharon. Would you like to enlighten everybody, Bernie?
Well, I spent 20 years working in an apartment hotel building and 15-story structure and 104 suites. You get to learn a few things. You get to understand the role of everything from collecting the rent to managing the space, refitting the space, saving money up, building up a reserve fund, I should say, to different trades and services. Everything electrical, HVAC, and it just keeps going. Roof, been through a couple elevator overhauls, HVAC overhaul. Some things make you look and you go, if you see bricks kind of bowing out, getting a hold of the engineer, don't even have him say it's okay, but we should include it in the budget for next year.
There you go. So the listeners should know. I mean, you know, Bernie just isn't here for color. Bernie actually has some valuable experience, and I'm sure you've got some tremendous stories. Does any one in particular come to mind, Bernie, right now that you can share with us?
Most colorful one I can actually express was the one time when the earthquake was hitting and going out, and this was about halfway through my tenure at that location, knowing that the engineer had been through the building several times, the concrete was going to hold, especially when the lights went out and I'm in the bottom of the building. In a certain dark little room, trying to, that's not a train. We don't have any trains coming by here. So, you know, I appreciate things that work, good maintenance.
Tremendous. Boy, oh boy, I remember that earthquake like it was yesterday. I remember looking outside the window, hearing exactly what I thought was a train or a plane. I wasn't sure which. And looking out the window and just seeing the buildings in and around the area just waving like they were on wave, on the water, on a wave. It was the most unusual thing you could ever possibly imagine seeing. And if you haven't seen it, well, I'm sure you can do without. There we go. So tremendous. Thank you, Bernie. That's really enlightening. So let's move on to In the News.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
I found an article a couple days ago that was actually published in the Globe and Mail through Reuters and written by an individual by the name of Nicola Semeter. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. Anyways, it appeared in the August 16th, 2021 version of the Globe and Mail. And, you know, people are always asking, what's the next trend? You know, how do you read the market? What's happening? Well, this article sheds some interesting light on what is happening right now in some of the major cities in Canada, more notably Toronto and Vancouver. Let me quote or paraphrase what's written here. Condominium markets in some of Canada's biggest cities have rebounded strongly this year. The condo market, which cooled quickly last year during the pandemic, as investors fled, and many of our listeners did, who were spooked by the exodus of renters from cities with families or find cheaper places elsewhere, primarily outside of the city. There was a huge number of investors said the condo market is failing. We're going to divest ourselves and move out back into the country or into the suburbs. Well, the reality is that now that things have eased up. The short-term rental demand, which dried up, has rebounded exponentially. Employees and students are returning to offices and universities, and the market is bracing itself for a strong bounce back in immigration that is more than adequate to make up for the pandemic-driven declines. And younger buyers are also returning to condos because the price for bigger homes has surged way past their ability to purchase them. So there's a very, very strong rental market in the major cities. And that's going to trickle down to secondary cities like Ottawa, Hamilton, Montreal, if we're not already seeing it. So keep that in mind. Don't be shy about looking at condominium apartments. The market ebbs and flows. So at the end of the day, this article goes on to say that they quote an individual by the name of Nasma Ali, who is the founder of One Group Toronto Real Estate. And he says that around July, with vaccinations progressing, lockdowns winding down, and a return to offices and in-person learning anticipated, the rental market has heated up again, with multiple offers and landlords achieving rents well above asking price. Now, isn't that just wonderful news to your ears? Anyways, she goes on to say that she wouldn't be the least bit surprised if some people actually look back on this entire pandemic experience and say, you know what, I've made a mistake, I want to move back to the city. So shrinking available supply is further boosting the condo sales market, according to John Pasalis from Realosophy. He goes on to say that construction started on about 1,143 apartment and condo units in June in Toronto. That's down over a third from a year previous and almost half the level of 2 years ago. That's because builders have scaled back their developments or scaled back progress on their developments because, like everyone else, they also felt that maybe there was going to be this mass exodus outside of the city. And they were quite concerned about the success of their condominium projects. Now, the one thing you need to keep in mind in Toronto, a very high proportion of condominium projects are pre-sold. I mean, it's a disproportional percentage amount. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if it's between 80 and 90%. So builders aren't necessarily worried once they have or start digging a hole in the ground. But when it came to the actual pre-sales, which they depend on, obviously, they just didn't have the market. They weren't the bodies to buy the units at the time. And this is kind of slowing down the whole process. So looking for a trend, don't be shy about condominium apartments, particularly in the major cities. So that's something to kind of chew on. What do you think about that, Bernie?
So do you think Ottawa is stabilized? Because I know a couple large buildings going up, especially along Carling Avenue near Preston and then closer to the Carlingwood areas, and actually Westgate too. So they're popping up some really tall buildings there.
Yeah, there are some tremendous projects scheduled for the city, and there are blocks of development land that all of a sudden have become available. And I think you're going to see a situation. There's still, you know, a real need for rental accommodation. It's not so dissimilar to what's happening in Toronto and Vancouver. We may in Ottawa lag behind somewhat, but if you take a look at the market trends in some of the larger cities, inevitably what's going to end up happening is that you're going to see the same type of thing occur in Ottawa. Ottawa has always been an extremely, extremely stable market, probably the most stable market in all of Canada. And I don't think I'm saying anything most of our listeners don't already appreciate. So at the end of the day, has Ottawa stabilized? Well, stabilized in what sense? There's a number of projects coming on board. Those projects, I'm sure, will be eaten up and picked up by investors. I think we're quickly, as the article states, I think we're quickly getting to the point where the market is going to reach pre-pandemic levels. Did we have a relatively equal market back then? Well, some would argue not. Some would argue there was still a real distinct shortage of rental accommodation. And that's not something that can be corrected over a matter of months. It's something that needs to be corrected over a number of years. So it's a little difficult to kind of answer that question point blank. But you get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Good. Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for the question, Bernie. Today we have a special guest. Kurt Frohman is joining us from Pynchon. Welcome aboard, Kurt.
Thanks, Fred. Happy to be here.
A little bit about Kurt. Kurt Frohman grew up in the Niagara region and moved to the Ottawa area in 2013. He is married to his wonderful wife, Alyssa, and has a beautiful 2.5-year-old daughter named Serena. And he resides in the Stittsville area, which we won't hold against you, Kurt. Kurt began his career as a project technologist with Pynchon soon after arriving in the big city in 2013, getting his hands dirty in the field. And he's worked his way up to project manager. He's completed over 1,200 phase one ESAs over his 8-year career in the industry, has been involved in all sorts of additional environmental projects, such as phase two ESAs and groundwater monitoring programs. Again, welcome, Kurt. Anything you care to add?
That's a pretty thorough intro. No, thanks for emphasizing the 1,200. Yeah, pretty proud of that. It's been a busy 8-year start in the industry for sure.
Yeah, that's an amazing number. Now, to those listeners who maybe don't know what an ESA is, it's an environmental site assessment. And anytime you go to a financial institution or you purchase a property, this is a consideration. Gone are the days when a financial institution, when you're applying for a mortgage, isn't going to ask for some sort of assurances when it comes to an environmental site assessment. And Kurt is here to answer some of the most relevant questions in that regard. So listen carefully, because this is the man with the answers. So we've got a compiled a list of questions here, Kurt. And let's start off with the first most obvious. What is a phase one ESA and what does it involve?
Sure. So yeah, you touched on the purpose of it and why they're needed. You know, if you're looking to go acquire a property, and just to be clear, I guess not everyone, the reason, I mean, we're teaching listeners today about a phase one ESA because your typical single family home, you get a mortgage on that, you don't come across the need for a phase one environmental assessment. So when you're going multi-tenant residential, you're buying a commercial property, industrial property, then the bank's going to ask for a phase one environmental assessment, which is the first of, and hopefully only assessment you'd need done, right? So there's phase one, phase two, phase three. I know we'll touch on each of those, but the phase one is a condition of financing for the bank to provide financing. And then it's also for your own due diligence, because you'd like to know, and the bank would like to know, if the property you're looking at has any form of soil or groundwater contamination. So are there any levels in the soil or the groundwater that would exceed what the ministry accepts? What we do is, could be anywhere from say 2 to 4 weeks typically. And we do a site inspection. So we'll meet with someone on site who is knowledgeable of the property, and we'll have a list of questions, and we'll tour through property and any buildings. And we're looking for some key things that could point to an issue. And then at the same time, we've ordered historical records on the property and the nearby properties. I'll get into that, and regulatory records as well. So we put all this information together and we come up with a professional opinion on whether there's a probability of contamination to be at this property in soil or groundwater. So we put together a report that summarizes all our findings, explains, you know, all the information we reviewed and explains our findings. So the phase one, any purchaser likes to see what they call a clean report. Well, there's a low likelihood of contamination at the property, and we don't recommend a phase two ESA. So that, in a nutshell, is what we do.
So that's great news for any investor out there. A clean ESA report. That's tremendous. Do you have any questions, Bernie? Anything come to mind?
So if you're buying a house, if it's a new build, I guess you don't have to worry about it. But if it's an older build, do you have to worry about an ESA in that type of space where lead paint would have been prevalent, asbestos would have been used, stuff like that?
The ESA would also touch on hazardous materials, designated substances like lead paints, lead, asbestos. And we also look at potential for mold. It's pretty high level in a phase one ESA, but you're right, we do touch on that. And
usually, just to kind of finish the loop, an ESA is used primarily by or for the purchase of commercial slash investment like buildings, but a homeowner can also request an ESA. Is that correct? Would it be safe to say that it would be highly unusual for a financial institution to request an ESA on a residential property? Or is that fairly commonplace?
Unusual. Yes, very unusual. Okay. Like if it's not an investment property and it's just your standard mortgage or remortgage of your home, you're not going to need one in 90 something percent of cases. But we do assessments quite often of just a residential home on a property, but it may have been triggered from there's a redevelopment about to go on. So the land's being acquired to then knock it down and build something else. Like, so that's one trigger. And actually, when you were discussing earlier about the rental market and how hot it's become again, we're seeing a lot of that too. We're seeing a lot of our bigger clients, say they have a property with a tower on it already, multi-res building. You know, if they have then a parking area and some vacant land there, a lot of them are looking at going through the, say in Ottawa, the site plan approval process with the city to then build another tower. Because exactly. The demand is so high, the exactly. rental market is back, it's very hot. So we're seeing that. And then we're also seeing, you know, especially along the O train, along that route, clients looking ahead a bit, but looking at redeveloping, you know, say, you know, a group of single family homes into knock those down, build a multi-res building. So, you know, that's obviously a hot area that spreads right across east to west across the city. So I touched briefly the phase one that I described so far, typical for bank financing and standard due diligence. So that's what's called a CSA style phase one. That's the standards that we follow for that. Now I mentioned these redevelopment projects. Sometimes say you have a commercial property, you know, if you're commercial and you want to redevelop into residential for that opportunity, there is a different style phase one that's needed. So then this can come as a shock to a lot of people. So when you're going to a more sensitive land use, you have to file what's called a record of site condition. And that is a pretty lengthy process, first of all. It's where the Ministry of Environment is involved. They're going to review your work and they're actually a lot more strict. They don't give us room for opinion, really. They give us, you know, if it's different because if we're on site for a standard assessment and we see a transformer, this is the probably best example. So those green boxes on a property, you know, we do searches, we observe it. If there's no rainfall or no snow or anything, we can clearly see there's been no leaks from it, at least to the outsides of it. You know, there's no spills in our searches that have been reported. We wouldn't make that transformer an issue for a property. But when you go through the record of site condition process, you have no choice but to drill in the area of a transformer to confirm that nothing has happened. That's one way that this record of site condition process can get expensive and time consuming, but it's necessary if you want to convert to a more sensitive land use. So it's just a different type of study I just wanted to touch on.
Thanks, Kurt. That's tremendous. For most of our listeners, that's not something that they're going to have to do in the early stages of their investing career or life, but it's really great information to know. Obviously, the next thing when we're dealing with phase one ESAs is where do you gather up all this information to complete a report?
Sure. That's a good question. It's a combination of, like I said, historical records and historical regulatory records, meaning so regulatory being we file a freedom of information search with the Ministry of Environment, see what they have on the property. And if a nearby property, we have some knowledge or it concerns us, we'll file a search for that one as well. Another regulatory body we file a search with is the Technical Standards and Safety Authority, the TSSA, and they govern fuel tanks throughout the province. And then depending on what city the assessment's in, we'll file some searches with the city as well. So there's one for Ottawa as well. Aside from that, the main two businesses that hold records that we're interested in are Environmental Risk Information Services, commonly known as ERIS. They pull records from all over the place and then put together a report for you. And it's anything from spill records to former current landfill sites. And then waste generation is a big one. So we can kind of look at an operation, what's there, and then look at what waste they generate, what quantities, and get that as well through another source. But
How long does it take once you put in the request, Kurt, how long does it actually take to get the report back from ARIS?
It takes approximately a week.
Oh, okay. So not too bad. Okay. All right.
Yeah. And similar to that, about a week is another business we file search with is Opta Information Intelligence. Actually, they were acquired by ARIS. So now it's all through ARIS, but they have a different kind of suite of records. They have fire insurance plans. So like these old manual drawings of buildings on like street blocks and everything. And it shows anything from the construction of a roof to what we look for are these cylindrical shapes that show underground storage tanks and just the operations back then. And they can give a lot of information. And then also old insurance inspection reports and drawings and that. So they can tell us heating source. If it was heating oil, then we're going to look into that further. Those are common ones. And then aerial photographs and city directories are the other two main ones we look at. Aerial photographs going back every decade for as long as we can, as early as we can. And city directories for, you know, listings for who occupied the property and nearby properties as far back as we can as well. Although they've been, with the pandemic, they've been closed. So that's been a bit of a limitation for us, but we still can get a good understanding of everything without that, right? Typically, we like to do that as well.
Well, that sounds like it's a pretty exhaustive search.
Yeah. That's why when everyone comes to us saying we need this like right away, look, you're the last piece of the puzzle here. We need your assessment next week. And it's like, oh, okay.
Not completely in your hands.
Exactly.
And I think I'd be one of those clients that have said just that. What do you mean it's going to take 3-4 weeks?
So Kurt, how much does it cost to run a study like this?
So a phase one, say you have a smaller property, like less than, 3 acres as a picking a number, something reasonably smaller or medium sized. And then it's local, it's in the auto area. And we actually go by address as well. Like if there's 5 addresses, we have 5 addresses to file searches for, which then costs us more. You know, that could raise the price a little bit. So typically in the industry, you'll see anywhere from 1800 to, you know, 3,300, 3,500. Now, what can affect it is, if we have some time and travel to go, say, up into Pembroke or Petawawa, or if we're going, you know, out to
Deep River,
a small town east of this, Deep River, right? Yeah. And, or if we're going south and like to near Cornwall or something, we have some time and travel to add in. Doesn't amount to a whole lot though. We're not talking it's going to double or anything. We're like another couple $100 or something. If a client comes to us and they say, look, this is an industrial site and I have these 10 or 12 previous reports, you know, there's a lot to review for us. It's going to add time for our review and we're going to have to add a little bit more there as well.
Fantastic. Yeah. So let's talk about some of the common misconceptions around environmental site assessments. You know, there's all sorts of them. What have you heard, Kurt?
You know, people will often come and say, you're coming for the phase one inspection on whatever, Thursday. They assume that we're coming to actually start collecting samples and testing that. And they think that's all, first of all, they think that's all included in the cost of the phase one, but that's a misconception. Like the phase one is more of a background review and a site inspection, but just for information and observations more than anything. So there's no sampling done in a phase one or phase two. And that's important because it's not putting the cart before the horse. Not all operations that you would think are concerning, like an automotive servicing is a typical one, or a gas station, right? Dry cleaners, they used to be really ugly. They're better managed now. But just because, say, the property we're assessing is an automotive servicing, for example, doesn't mean we're going right to a phase two.
So what's involved in completing a phase two? Should there be some sort of indication while or during the phase one that maybe further investigation is needed? So what are you going to do about it?
The phase one findings will guide the phase two, right? So the phase two group would look at the concerns identified, and you have typically from there, we can develop a plan to investigate. So how many boreholes do we want to drill? How many of those do we want to complete as groundwater monitoring wells so we can test groundwater as well. You know, we come up with a plan. From there, if we get the approval, file locates. So we have to do public and private locates to basically get that drawn out. So we make sure we don't hit any utility lines, right? We don't want to hit gas lines, water lines, electrical. Got to be careful. So and sometimes that can kind of alter our drilling a little bit, but typically we can still get what we need. And then, yeah, we plan a drill date. We go on site with our subcontracted drilling company and aim for these locations. And, you know, while they're drilling and they're pulling up core samples, we're analyzing, collecting samples. And then groundwater is done kind of after the fact. They develop the well and come back and purge it. Then you come back and sample it. So that takes a couple of days after that. But, you know, we're looking for worst case soil samples, we call them. You know, they could have the highest vapor readings of petroleum if that's what we're investigating. And then from there, we collect samples, submit them to the lab. We get that analysis back and we compare. And when we give it to the lab, we tell them what parameters we want analyzed. And that can really affect costs as well. We get the analysis back based on the property we're assessing. You know, is it residential, commercial, industrial? There's different things that can affect what criteria we have to use. So then we compare the analysis to the criteria and we see if there's any exceedances of the standards set out by the Ministry of Environment. So when we have exceedances, then we have to kind of explore the next step. They can be minor and insignificant in a sense that, say you have a parking lot at a plaza and it's asphalted over and there's a little bit of metal contamination in the soil only. So we know it's static. We know it's not going anywhere. It's really not hurting anybody being there. We can safely say it's environmentally insignificant. Let's leave that in place and it can be dealt with on redevelopment of a property. Because if it's not going to hurt anybody, if it's not going to travel off site, get worse from operations or anything, then it costs a lot to clean up properties. So it really doesn't make sense to clean that up in that scenario. So yeah, all depending on what a phase two finds. Again, you hope it's clean. You hope you don't find anything and you can move forward with your life. But when you do find stuff, you got to, you know, explore the next step. It could be, let's drill again. Let's see how widespread the issue is. Well, typically that's the next step. A lot of times the first round of drilling doesn't give you enough to go right to a remediation if that's what the next step should be. There's just so many scenarios.
So what's a phase two going to cost us?
You know, low end we would see would be anywhere like around 8 to 10,000 is where it would start. That'd be likely investigating a single concern, you know, maybe a couple boreholes, one as a groundwater well with some soil and groundwater samples, like and local. And honestly, they can go high. They can shock you too. They're industrial areas. I mean, one comes to mind in the Armpire area that was, you know, between 50 and 60,000 for a phase two. But this is industrial land, large, large property, and a number of former concerns, but also contamination already found that had to be delineated. So let's see how widespread it was. And that's rare. Like I should say the range typically you would see, and that would be anywhere between 8 to 20,000 on the high end, 20,000, I would say. And 20,000 would be investigating a few concerns. So
we've got contamination. What do we do about it? What's involved when conducting a phase three or remediation on a property?
There are scenarios where, like we touched on, metal soil, metal impacted soil beneath a parking lot that we can likely leave in place. There are times where you don't need to maybe take the next step, at least not at this time. Maybe deal with it on redevelopment. Another scenario I'd touch on is, say, if you have an underground heating oil tank at a residential building, it's a common one. You'd think by now they've all been pulled and gotten rid of, but you still find them. So what we would do first is go and do what's called a ground penetrating radar. So basically, let's go scan the ground. It's like an X-ray of the ground in the area we suspect the tank is or was. And it'll show us anomalies that'll show, you know, either was there a tank there and now there's fill material there that's different from the native soil? Or is there still a tank there? And from there, we might not do phase two, right? There's no point in drilling around it to see if it's contaminated. You might go straight to pulling the tank. So remediation, because there's no point in really drilling when you know you're just going to pull the tank and clean it up anyway. So, and those are typically straightforward tank pulls. They're, you know, you just need a TSSA licensed contractor there and your remediation contractors to pull it, properly dispose of it. Well, first they, you know, decommission the tank or do what they need to do. They fill it with like a slurry and it gets pulled. And then it's basically confirmatory sampling around it. So let's dig out soil until we think it's all the contaminated soil is gone. And then let's take some samples at throughout the excavation to see, and then submit those for analysis. And if all those come back clean, then we can pretty safely say that we've taken care of that issue and we can backfill with clean material. And that's a common remediation. So, and typically with petroleum related contamination, it's a dig and dump for soil, and groundwater is a little different, but I don't know it as well, I'll be honest. And then when you're dealing with something like the former dry cleaners, which used to use those nasty solvents and they wouldn't manage them well, and they would, you know, throw them out the back door and they just sink into groundwater and then they spread like crazy. You know, I'm sure you've heard the story of Anatik going to city services.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, Carlton Place had an issue as well that are ongoing. Those are very difficult to remediate. You know, they spread quickly. So they typically dealing with a wider area than you would petroleum. And then there's different ways of going at it, but it can take quite a bit of time to break it down.
Yeah,
perchloroethylene, you know, breaks down four times, I think, before it actually dissipates. So you got to keep treating it, breaking it down, and it can be quite the process.
Yeah, I understand that in some instances, there's groundwater monitoring stations that have been in existence for decades. So yeah, it can be a very costly and involved process. And let's hope none of our listeners ever have to deal with contamination like that.
So other than the banks and insurance and other folks, Ministry of the Environment, do they track this? Is that public information too, by the way?
No, the assessments, they're your typical phase ones, the due diligence, bank financing phase ones, the CSA phase ones I mentioned, they're private. They're between us and our client. And when I mentioned the record of site condition, the redevelopment to more sensitive land use, then the Ministry of Environment's going to know what's going on if you go through with it and file it with them. So if you want to move forward that project, you have to file it with them. So,
yep.
But no, going back to our more common CSA phase ones, they're private. You know, we do them for people sometimes and they say they're acquiring a property. We find a number of concerns and they don't go through with a purchase. They kind of own this report, which is almost useless to them, but no one else really knows the findings unless they communicate it with someone. So we could come back 2 years later and do it again.
Are there any specific circumstances, and we may have touched on this already, but where there is contamination, we just don't have to, and you've touched on it actually a couple of times, Kurt, where even though there is contamination, remediation just isn't necessary at all?
Say an underground fuel tank was pulled years ago. They tested the soil around it and everything passed at the time. It got backfilled. 10 years later, we come into a phase one. We review the report where they pulled the tank and they tested the soil. We review the analytical there, compare it to the new standards because they had changed. So say now what used to pass now fails for a couple petroleum parameters in the soil. That's considered contamination because it exceeds the standard. However, petroleum dissipates over time or attenuates, as we like to use that word in our reports. But, you know, we wouldn't say dig it up. We need all the soil to pass. It's probably a couple meters underground. It exceeds by a minor amount and it's going to dissipate. So there's an example where you don't need to clean that up. We would say minor and insignificant will dissipate over time. No further work warranted. So,
wow. Music to my ears.
Yeah.
I like to see that on more ESA reports. That is fantastic. Yeah. Tell me, what's the best way for our listeners to contact you if they find themselves in need of an environmental site assessment? What's your email address?
It's K Frohman. So K F as in Frank, R O M M A N N at Pinchin, PINCHIN.com.
Kurt, thank you so much. This has been just invaluable, and I hope an invaluable resource for our listeners. I don't know how many times I'm asked about ESAs, all levels, and what to expect. And I think you've done a brilliant job in answering and alleviate some, but not all, of our concerns. So with that, we thank you, Kurt. It's tremendous to have you as a guest. Now we're going to move on to...
It's time for the Property Wizard's Word of the Day.
So for the word of the day today, and I had a real good one picked out, but after listening to Kurt, I'm going to throw it right back at our guest. Kurt, give us a Frohman Notes version, an explanation for the word attenuate.
Attenuate. Oh, good one. So I would say the natural decrease in number or value over time.
In reference to contamination, we're talking about oil levels, contamination.
We're talking about, let's say oil and gas, petroleums.
Perfect. Thank you very much for that. And I really appreciate you being a great sport about it, considering we gave you no notice. Yeah. So, listeners, next podcast, we're going to be talking about distressed properties, one of my favorite topics. You're going to learn how to identify them and what you can do to include them and maximize their value. So with that, remember, you can save $250 on your next Gentry Learning course by using the phrase podcast, one word, all in capitals, when checking out.
Oh, one thing to add there, Freddie, we should also say if there are any questions from the audience, to send them to info@gentryres.com. It's info at gentry, G-N-T-R-Y, res, R-E-S.com. All one word.
Beautiful. Thanks for the reminder, Bernie. I know we got sidetracked in our mailbag today. Again, thank you for subscribing. And remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities.
Thanks for joining Freddie on another edition of The Property Wizard. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentryres.com. Until next time, remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities.